Hello and welcome to The Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, massive vacancies on the federal bench and justices with conflicts of interest. What is the state of the independent judiciary? Then, should people who committed crimes as teenagers face life in prison with no chance for parole? A look at the laws and the 2,500 people in the U.S. who are serving those sentences. Finally, on the Scholar Circle, the effect of war on laws, society, governance, and democracy itself. How are these affected as the lines of wartime are increasingly blurred? Last week, more than 200 law professors joined with judicial watchdog groups in calling for the Supreme Court to adopt, voluntarily, the Code of Conduct for U.S. judges, which currently does not apply to Supreme Court justices, some who've been appearing at fundraisers for advocacy groups. The ethical concerns, along with the large numbers of vacancies on the federal bench, are creating concerns for judicial watchdog groups. We're joined now by Nan Aaron, the director of the Alliance for Justice. Welcome, Nan Aaron.
Thank you.
Great to have you with us. So I wanted to start with the statement that Alliance for Justice has made about how the next year the court will hear and decide on some of the most controversial and contentious cases in its history. And you say this is why it's such an important time to ensure judicial ethics. Can you give us the highlights of these cases that you see as the most important now before the judiciary?
In a few weeks, we will hear the landmark argument surrounding the health care law passed by Congress a few years ago. We are going to hear a major affirmative action case, a case dealing with immigrant rights and voting rights. So this is really a landmark year for the Supreme Court. There will be very big cases and intense public scrutiny. It is our belief that if there were ever a time for the court to buttress public confidence in its objectivity, this is it. There just has to be confidence in the judiciary with so much at stake. Don't think we want any hint of favoritism or bias. And yet, we have seen instances where some of those who sit on our highest court, namely Justices Thomas, Scalia, and Alito, engage in activities that, if they were lower court judges, would be absolutely prohibited. For instance, we've seen Justices Thomas and Scalia attend and lend their names to big fundraising events held by the Federal Society. We saw Justice Alito speak at a fundraising dinner for the Heritage Foundation and the American Spectator, a right-wing magazine. And in 2008, two of the justices, Scalia and Thomas, attended a conference of the Koch brothers. Now, judges and justices can attend conferences. That's not a problem. However, they are prohibited, that is, lower court judges, from attending conferences where politics is discussed. And in the case of the Koch brothers conference in 2008, a major topic of discussion was how Republicans can take back the Senate as well as the White House. And for a lower court judge, attendance at this kind of conference would be just outright prohibited. And yet we see these two justices go there, and one of whom, Clarence Thomas, gave a speech about his book. That creates great unease about their integrity and I think raises questions about whether or not they're acting in good faith and acting ethically.
So specifically, they're not to attend conferences that pertain to electoral politics, not
exactly
necessarily any kind of politics.
Exactly. By the same token, lower court judges can attend fundraising events. However, they can't lend their name or prestige to events. For instance, they can't allow their picture to be on an invitation to an event. With these three justices, we saw instances where, in fact, they were on the invitations, they were singled out at these fundraising dinners. That's just prohibited. And what we have asked is that the Chief Justice, John Roberts, adopt the Code of Conduct that applies to all lower court judges. Not only has Alliance for Justice asked him to adopt the code, but in fact, we delivered over 100,000 petitions last week to the court. There are dozens and dozens of members of the House who have asked the Chief Justice to adopt the code of conduct. And when you think about it, it's not asking that much. This code applies to all the judges. All we're asking is the Chief Justice apply the code to the 9 justices, and we think it's particularly important given that now there's instances where several of the justices have engaged in activities that raise important ethical questions.
There was a time earlier as well that Clarence Thomas came under scrutiny, partly by your organization, but other organizations as well, and he was called upon to recuse himself from a case. What has happened since then?
Several groups have actually called on Justice Thomas to recuse himself from hearing the upcoming health care case. There have also been a number of groups that have asked Justice Elena Kagan to recuse herself from hearing the case. Both justices have indicated that they will, in fact, sit in and hear arguments. So I think calls for recusal have simply been rejected by these two justices. And in these two instances, I'm not sure that either justice has to recuse himself or herself. What we at Alliance for Justice are saying is that it doesn't seem right that the justice whose behavior is in question should be the justice that decides whether or not he or she should recuse themselves from any particular case. We all remember the case a few years ago that involved the Sierra Club asking Justice Scalia to recuse himself because it turned out he and Dick Cheney had gone duck hunting after the Supreme Court had accepted a case involving Vice President Cheney's Energy Task Force. People in that case asked Scalia to recuse himself. He refused and wrote a lengthy opinion. But again, that's an instance where perhaps we ought not rely on the justice whose behavior is believed to be compromised, but rather ask the remaining 8 justices, or perhaps ask retired justices, to render a decision on the recusal.
In the end, we have not had the court adopt such a code of conduct so far, and that is despite the fact that some 200 law professors have joined in with this request and the 100,000 signatures that you've delivered.
I'm so glad you mentioned the over 200 law teachers, because they've certainly weighed in on this issue as well. We all need to continue to exert pressure to write to Chief Justice John Roberts. We know, in fact, that he is very much aware of this issue and devoted his entire annual report last December to a discussion of judicial ethics. I can't imagine that Justices Scalia and Thomas or Alito are going to discontinue their attendance at certain events. He could lay to rest these tremendous concerns about judicial ethics by simply saying, we're going to adopt the code of conduct. What we're concerned about is the need to close the ethics loophole once and for all. We believe that the Chief Justice is risking the trust of the American people by failing to adopt the code.
It's been a lot of decades since we've seen any kind of disciplinary action taken on Supreme Court justices. It seems like that is so far out of reach in today's society. But are there other means of judicial discipline in the cases of violation of ethics?
There is another issue that relates to a statute called the Ethics in Government Act, which requires many federal employees to file accurately their financial disclosure statements. It recently came to light that, in fact, Justice Thomas erroneously filed his report, omitting the fact that for several years his spouse, Ginny Thomas, worked and received a salary from the Heritage Foundation to lobby against the enactment of health care reform. And it also may be the case that there are other gifts and activities and favors he's received that he has failed to report. In this particular instance, we have asked the Judicial Conference of the United States to contact the Justice Department and ask for an investigation of Justice Thomas's failures to accurately disclose income on his report. What Clarence Thomas has said is that he believes that the forms are too complicated. I have always found that excuse a little puzzling, given the fact that he is a Supreme Court justice and almost everyone else manages to file these forms accurately. It certainly gives one the impression that this was a rather flagrant, obvious omission by Justice Thomas simply to ignore the requirements contained in the Ethics in Government Act.
The other big issue in the judiciary now is this kind of massive vacancy on the federal bench. How big is it, and how is it affecting the courts at this point?
As of today, there are 100 vacancies on our courts, our federal district courts and courts of appeal. A vacancy has very real-life implications to everyday Americans who, when they have a problem, they've been thrown off the Social Security rolls, they discover that they were overcharged by their credit card company. Anything. They fail to get a promotion unjustly. Their workplaces have hazardous materials that are causing great physical harm. The federal courts have always served as the forum through which everyday people go and have their problems addressed. Everyday people, unless they've given a big campaign contribution to their member of Congress, it's difficult for them to get through, to speak to a House or Senate member. So the courts have always been that branch that has the door open for Americans through which they can stand up for their rights. And the fact that there are vacancies, that there are not enough judges to hear these cases, means that people aren't getting justice. We see the Republicans engaged in a deliberate effort to prevent President Obama's nominees from getting confirmed. And there's a very simple reason why they're blocking votes and being obstructionist. They are making every effort they can to hold seats open on the assumption that a future Republican president will then be able to fill the vacancies with their judges. But at the moment, we've got almost one out of every 9 seats on our federal courts vacant. And I think what is so unprecedented with what's going on is that so many of the judicial nominees sent up by President Obama enjoy both Republican and Democratic support. So it's not that Republicans object to the fact that the nominees are too progressive. It's simply a political ploy to block votes, hold open seats for Republicans to fill in the future.
We're seeing now really a Democratic majority in the Senate cannot actually move these through because of a filibuster.
Just yesterday, the Republicans, led by Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, filibustered 17 nominees, or threatened to filibuster, just before the vote. Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid agreed on a deal that would allow 14 of the nominees to get a vote, not the full 17. And that's good news, but it's a small step forward because actually these 17 judges could have been and should have been confirmed within a matter of minutes. And what this deal provides is that these votes on just these 14 will be strung out now for the next 3 months. It's important to know that by the end of their first terms, George W. Bush had 204 judges confirmed. President Bill Clinton had 201 judges confirmed. We believe 200 judges should be the goal for President Obama.
And how many has he had?
At the moment, he's had 129 judges confirmed. He will be the first president in many, many years to leave his first term with more vacancies than existed when he came into office. The people who lose out are not the Democratic senators, or not President Obama. It's people like us who only have the courts to turn to for resolution of problems that afflict us.
Well, Nan Aaron, that's where we're going to have to leave it. But thank you so much for joining us. Nan Aaron is the director of the Alliance for Justice. You can read more at their website at www.afj.org. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
You are listening to The Insiders, Insight into Today's Most Pressing Issues. I'm Maria Armudian. Across the United States, 2,500 people who are serving life sentences without the possibility of parole were convicted while they were teenagers. How should the law treat crime that's committed by children and teenagers? Should it be treated differently than crime committed by adults? We are joined now by Elizabeth Calvin. She is Senior Advocate with the Children's Rights Division of Human Rights Watch. Welcome, Elizabeth Calvin. Great to have you with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
How did we get to a point legally to be punishing in this way?
I think the best way to think about it is that 20 years ago, we had a number of things that happened that really threw our society into a panic that teenagers were increasingly dangerous. So there were some very high-profile cases. There were social researchers who were predicting that teenagers were becoming less and less remorseful or able to, you know, control their behavior, and that we were headed towards this firestorm of violence from teens. And that proved to be completely untrue. And yet what happened was states across the country changed their laws. And basically, although public opinion, social research, science has all come to the conclusion that these kind of extreme sentences for young people just don't make sense, and that teenagers are no different than they ever have been, and pretty much everybody is aware of that, but the law has not yet caught up.
It seemed from the report that I read online that the preponderance of the crimes, maybe not the preponderance, but a significant percentage, were teenagers that weren't actually committing the crime so much as abetting the crime.
Human Rights Watch has researched this. One of the more shocking factors that we've come across in California is that we estimate about 45% of youth who have been sentenced to life without parole were not the person who physically committed the crime. They were not the trigger person. And I think pretty much everyone would agree that even if by law, in California, if you commit a crime with a felony with somebody and someone is unexpectedly killed during the course of that felony, everybody is responsible to the same level as the person who actually pulled the trigger. Even if by law somebody is culpable for the or responsible for the murder, pretty much everybody can agree that if you were not the trigger person, you're not quite as responsible as the person who did pull the trigger. I think this is even more true when you talk about teenagers who are not as good as adults at thinking through the possible consequences or the risks of certain actions.
In fact, we've addressed this issue of youth in other circumstances, such as child soldiering that is going on a great deal in some of the African wars. And one of the realizations of experts is that children just have not developed their ethical core yet. When looking at law enforcement, what should be done in terms of children versus adults? What are the current legal parameters for that now? And does it take any of this into consideration?
At the very essence of this issue is the fact that children and teenagers are different from adults. Teenagers, well into late adolescence, into the late teens, And even young adults are still developing. They're developing emotionally, but even more importantly, they're developing neurologically. And it's just a well-accepted scientific fact that teens are still developing the ability to resist impulse, analyze risks, understand the consequences of actions. It really has nothing to do with whether they understand right from wrong or whether they know that crime is a bad thing. It's more has to do with their ability to make good decisions, particularly in quickly moving situations, and you know, resist impulse, resist peer pressure. And these are all things that are more difficult for teenagers than they are for adults. And there are things that are, you know, obviously very much related to criminal behavior. And unfortunately, in California and many other states, there's no real consideration of the fact that somebody is a teenager when they commit the crime. Our laws tend to only look at the seriousness of the crime. For example, in California, if someone is charged with murder, and they're under the age of 18, their case is immediately and kind of automatically filed in adult court. There's no analysis of whether the individual is amenable to rehabilitation, whether he or she came from a particularly difficult situation as a child. The issue is, what is the crime? And if that individual is 16 or 17, and sometimes in some cases younger than that, they are headed to adult court where they are facing adult penalties. And frankly, everybody in the courtroom is participating in a myth that this individual is no longer a juvenile, but is instead, you know, somebody who's going to be treated as an adult and face adult penalties.
Now, I imagine part of the harshness of this developed out of the intent to deal with gang behavior, but that ends up looping a lot of people in that are not participating in gangs. Do you have any sense of the breakdown?
We don't have clear data on that because actually, that circumstance, that special circumstance under the law wasn't added in until later, so we don't know out of all of the cases how many were gang-involved or not gang-involved. So as we look at each of these factors, I think it's important to always come back to this basic reality that we're talking about teenagers. We're talking about individuals who have tremendous capacity to grow, mature, change, to become individuals who are not fully defined by what they were doing at age 15 or 16 or 17. This isn't the kind of situation where someone gets this sentence and then 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years down the line, their case can be reviewed if they've proved to be a good person. Life without parole is just that. It is very much a sentence to die in prison, and there is no review.
Your organization has followed some youth offenders and found considerable change in development.
Yes, that is right. I've interviewed many individuals who are now in their 30s, went into prison or the juvenile facilities when they were 16. This one young man described to me, he said when I interviewed him, he was 35. When he was about 25, he felt like a light bulb went on, and he looked up and looked around and thought, what am I doing here? This is not how I want to live my life. And what I have found is that many of these individuals are filled with remorse for what they did as a teenager and are doing everything they can to live their lives in a way to make up for that. We see individuals who are focusing on reading self-help books, on doing meditation, on trying to help other prisoners. In one of the women's prisons, there are a group of women who, as juveniles, who were sentenced to life in prison, and they've started what they're calling the Juvenile Lifers Committee, and they meet on a weekly basis and help each other basically rehabilitate, refocus, and redirect their lives and live as if someday they would go before a parole board. That same group ended up organizing a rather difficult thing to organize in prison, and that was a pizza sale. And they got an outside organization to bring pizza into the prison, and they sold the pizza. They made $5,000 and donated it to a local Boys and Girls Club. We see incredible examples of individuals who really have become very different than the person who was involved with the crime when they were age 16. 16 or 17.
We've got a couple of things coming up, Supreme Court cases that will be dealing with these issues, but we also have legislation. Tell us about the Supreme Court case and the legislation.
Next week, the U.S. Supreme Court will consider two cases, both involving 14-year-old boys who were involved with murders, convicted of murder, and sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Court will consider whether this sentence is unconstitutional, specifically whether it's cruel and unusual to sentence somebody under the age of 18 to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The court has, in its last several decisions about youth and criminal justice matters, has really strongly made statements about how juveniles are different from adults. Their culpability is different because of their developing nature. So we're very hopeful that the court will make a decision that this is an unconstitutional sentence. Oftentimes, the Supreme Court really rules in a very narrow way, so it could rule very narrowly just on the cases before it involving 14-year-olds. And the California State Legislature has been considering a bill that's very close to passing. And this bill would allow the individuals in California who are under the age of 18 at the time of their crime and were sentenced to life without parole to go back before a judge many years after they've been in prison, and have a judge review their cases and determine whether they merit a parole-eligible sentence. And what that means is that a judge would be really looking at this case and determining whether the sentence was correct or not after the individual has grown up and matured. If a judge determines that an individual does merit a parolable sentence, then that person will still have to go before the parole board and prove that he or she's been rehabilitated and really deserves to be paroled. The title of the bill is Senate Bill 9. It's passed in the Senate and is now pending in the Assembly. Really puts forth a very careful review process of these cases.
Well, all right. Thank you so much, Elizabeth Calvin, for being with us.
My pleasure.
Elizabeth Calvin is the Senior Advocate with Children's Rights Division of Human Rights Watch, and you can find out more at the website of Human Rights Watch, hrw.org. When we come back, how the changing definition of war and wartime impacts society, the law, and democracy itself. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. When will the wars be over and lives return to, quote, normal? Those times seem increasingly elusive as the lines between wartime and peacetime are blurred. The so-called time of war affects every aspect of life. It changes laws, civil liberties, and the public's relationship to the law, bending the laws in favor of security for the state, and ultimately affecting democracy itself. War also demarcates history eras. But what about when war seems to go on endlessly? What exactly is wartime, and how does that blurring of lines affect laws and society? Three experts join us now. Mary Dujack is professor of law, history, and political science at USC and author of several books, including Wartime, An Idea, Its History, Its Consequences. Patrick James also joins us. He's director of the Center for International Studies, a professor of international relations at USC and author of numerous books, including Religion, Identity, and Global Governance, Crisis in War, A New Quest for International Peace, and Wars in the Midst of Peace. Chris McKnight-Nichols joins us. He's professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Promise and Peril, America at the Dawn of a Global Age. Mary Dujack, let's begin with you. Your concept of wartime as a construct that has been kind of imagined, as you say, somewhat differently than its reality. How have we come to see wartime, and how does that articulation affect the fundamental legal and cultural aspects of life?
Wartime does a lot of work in American politics and culture. We see the concept of wartime often being used as an argument for why we should adopt policies like enhanced interrogation, for example, waterboarding. Why do we do things like this? Because it's wartime. When someone uses wartime as an argument, they're basically arguing that the nation's existence is at stake, but also that wartime means that what we're doing is going to go away, because built into the concept of wartime is the idea that war is, by definition, temporary. And the reason I say that is we imagine history proceeding from one kind of time to the next, from wartime to peacetime to wartime to peacetime. We imagine that there's a future called peacetime where war will not exist. So wartime brings with it the idea of war's temporariness. And the way that it figures in, we'll see, for example, the Supreme Court grappling with the question of how do we deal with the legality of detentions at Guantanamo. Well, under the law, enemy combatants can be detained for the duration of the conflict. And so these folks are being detained for the duration of the conflict. And yet the conflict, the way it's been articulated, doesn't have an end point. If it's a war on terror, the way Bush put it, if it's a war on Al-Qaeda, the way Obama has framed it, then these are wars against concepts or tactics or amorphous groups that aren't going to cease to exist anywhere in the world for a very, very, very long time, if ever. So we essentially have this idea that war is temporary, that wartime policies are therefore temporary, but that coexists with a context of ongoing warfare that doesn't fit the concept.
There are two directions I want to go in. One is going to be to bring in Pat James to look at this from the international relations perspective, and then with Chris McKnight Nichols to look at this historically in the United States of America. Pat James, within the context of international relations, wars, ethnic conflicts, what Manus Midlarsky calls systemic wars. What is the international political context for war, wartime, and peace?
I think Mary is right in her book with its emphasis on the evolution of a concept, this whole idea of wartime. It almost ends up being a major pun in that we close our eyes and we envision old movies where there's a home front and there's a fixed period of time where the boys go marching off and then they come home, and there's sort of an end point then, if you will. Somebody then wins the war, the winners write the peace, and so on and so forth, and they put the bad guys on trial. What she points out, I think, so well in her book is that whether you look at it as a cumulative, gradual process or something that's more binary because of 9/11, this whole notion that, quote-unquote, war is this discrete thing in time that you could make movies about, you could write books about, and that somehow it begins and ends, and then from a sort of international relations / international law standpoint, there's wartime law and there's peacetime law. All of that, by the time you get through her very masterful and easy-to-read work, all of that is gone. It's incinerated, and the situation is much more complex. I would say, for me, the most interesting thing from an international relations standpoint concerns the relationship of prosecuting a war to the legal foundations of going to war. And by that I mean the United States, for example, has not actually declared war on anybody since December 8, 1941, namely against Japan after Pearl Harbor. Since then, the U.S. has been involved in any number of military deployments, but there is nothing that looks exactly like a stereotypical war. And where we are is that the conflicts we have, like Afghanistan or whatever, they're not even really about a place anymore. They're sometimes, as Mary points out, about concepts, about tactics, whatever we might call them. One key thing for international relations scholars to think about then is because of this mushiness, this lack of boundaries, that the law and legal precepts are much more in play 24/7, 365 than they once were. My own particular comment on this, I made a number on a very interesting panel on Mary's book a while ago at the law school, is that we have to think very seriously about what we are willing to do and how far we're willing to go if we deploy force. I'll stop there for the moment, but I'm a big fan of thinking that parallels what's been known as the Powell Doctrine, as in if you're going to do it, then go all out and get it done and be extremely, extremely restricted in your usages of force.
Chris McKnight-Nichols, let's bring you in and take a look at this from the historic context in the U.S.
Mary makes some superb points in the book regarding the longer history of wartime, particularly in the 20th century. And here she really illuminates sort of the central paradoxes and the social constructedness of time, wartime and peacetime, as a kind of facile binary. And she begins with a great incident, unfortunate incident, the last peacetime casualty or wartime casualty in this case in East Germany of a fellow by the name of Arthur Nicholson. And the question is sort of severalfold, whether or not he deserves burial in Arlington National Cemetery, which he does receive, then what should be written on his gravestone, killed in East Germany, U.S. military liaison, doesn't state formally what conflict he was engaged in. And so this gets at to the question of what exactly was the Cold War, as a series of hot wars, of proxy conflicts. And then she opens that up to sort of think through what most Americans would perceive as perhaps the most discrete of conflicts, the Second World War, beginning for many Americans with Pearl Harbor, of course, and concluding with the peace signing on the battleship Missouri, or perhaps simply with the dropping of atomic bombs. And here, Mary's work also shows us what those of us in historical circles know well, the long lead time into these conflicts is just as important. One insight that I would draw from the book more broadly is that Americans are very often de facto committed to conflicts, whether they be small or large, World War I, World War II, Cold War examples. So too are small conflicts, such as American engagement in the Philippines, which lasted from 1898 through 1946, when the Philippines gets its formal independence. But the U.S. sort of has a vacillating relationship with these conflicts in terms of the sort of constructs of wartime and peacetime, and yet the commitments are just as strong. Troops are dying on the ground, just like Arthur Nicholson, who was laid to rest in 1985, and yet the sort of existential question about what is this war remains. And it strikes me that historically, pushing back even farther, we have several other questions related to this at the intersection of the law, history, and conflicts. Abraham Lincoln's famous suspension of habeas corpus and the related rulings on that in the Civil War era through the end of the 19th century, the Spanish-American War, and Mary's comments just now to start off our conversation reminded me of William James's remarks about something related. That is, he argued that a concept such as manifest destiny, which seemed to motivate so many Americans in conflicts, the sort of belligerency and passion of Americans in wartime, are really empty concepts. He argued that they were, quote, specious abstractions. But the problem, of course, is that there's a great traction of these kinds of concepts, like wartime or like manifest destiny, that make it particularly problematic in terms of democratic accountability in times of war.
I'm going to want to get back to the democratic accountability question. In fact, I was hoping to end with that. But before then, as we're looking at this kind of relationship between war, society, law, democratic participation, that is really all linked into when a war begins and when it ends. Mary, you have looked at several wars. World War II was one. The Cold War was another. The War on Terrorism was another. And they're very different kinds of wars. You tried to define them. What did you conclude?
What I do in the book is I start by taking apart the concept of wartime, and then I look at a series of examples to illustrate the pliability of the concept, the way that it doesn't fit into time boundaries the way we imagine it. So I look at World War II really not to define it better, but instead to illustrate that the way we think about World War II doesn't fit. And that's that it's now remembered as the good war, the quintessential kind of war, in part because it was a declared war, so it's thought of as having a definite starting point. And then it all ended with VJ Day, the Japanese surrender in 1945. But instead what happens is even that iconic war is fuzzy at the edges. The U.S. involvement ramps up over time, as Chris suggested, and U.S. involvement and deployments sort of continue on afterwards. The Cold War, then, is an interesting problem because, you know, how does the Cold War fit? Even the name, the Cold War, is incoherent because wars aren't cold. So it should cause us to think about what was this and does it actually serve as a useful comparison with other things we think of as a wartime? And what you see is there's just not a fit between this long period of diplomatic tension where the wars that are going on are usually proxy wars, smaller wars, different places in the world where there's a central adversary is the Soviet Union. So the Cold War itself doesn't fit within the usual definition of war, the way we tend to think about it. But what happens often in the scholarship, including the legal scholarship that uses different wars as examples to think about American war policy and the law over time, the Cold War is basically shoved back into the pre-existing, simpler conceptual framework that we have wartime and peacetime and we move from one to the other. Then the post-9/11 era is on some level a repeat of the Cold War history, where you have another period that simply doesn't fit the model, as we see so clearly now as first President Bush, then President Obama, trying to, at least as a matter of American politics, say that conflicts are ending, but they just won't end. And then we're sending military forces other places like drones over Pakistan and Yemen, etc. So what we have is this much messier era of ongoing conflict. But what scholars do is, at least in the law world, they start calling wartime something different because post-9/11 doesn't seem to fit. So then they call it a crisis time. They rename other war times as crisis, like World War II now is a crisis time, so that they can pair different crisis times against each other, but still have this general assumption that there's something called normal time that we experience that's periodically ruptured and then restored. And so that basic temporal set of ideas, which builds in the idea that war is by definition temporary, you enter it and those powers and those rights of compromises are by definition going to come to an end, that conceptualization lingers.
Pat James, let's bring you back in, because this muddling must really affect the international relations scholarship. How does the international relations field deal with counting them, knowing when they are resolving and not resolving, when you have this kind of gray area?
Yes. What has happened, if you follow the scholarship in the area, is there is an awareness of this change in that once upon a time, let's go back close to 50 years ago during the early days of high-speed computing and the ability to construct, you know, large-scale data sets, initially very discrete, very standard-looking events like World War II and others got packaged together into interstate war data sets. What we've seen since then is an awareness of two things. One is that the boundaries of such discrete events are breaking down. So instead of collecting data strictly about traditional interstate wars between two countries, scholars, in fact, over the last few decades have evolved toward not only collecting that, because sometimes we have things that look like a traditional old-fashioned war, like the first phase of Iraq in 2003. But then many of these conflicts, of course, don't end like an old-fashioned war. They morph into something else. A reasonable person could say that there's still some kind of conflict going on in Iraq right now, or for that matter, Afghanistan, even though at one point each of them was an old-school type of war. So the first thing that's changing is new kinds of data sets are being collected that reflect the fact that a lot of conflicts are going on in ways that are non-traditional, so they get new names or labels. You mentioned Midlarsky and his systemic concept. There are other things we could talk about. Data, believe it or not, was not collected on the subject of civil wars until quite recently. So you look at what Afghanistan or Iraq would be, and you'd have to say they didn't end up in the traditional old-style way where they had a clear point of termination. And the other thing that's going on, and it's connected, is that most of the casualties around the world from warfare are being experienced in unconventional types of events that are more civil than international and that do not have clear beginnings or endings. Some of them arguably are discrete. They're taking place inside the borders of one country, but some are not, like what went on in the mid-1990s in Africa. Some have called that Africa's Third World War, right, with the Congo and Rwanda and so on and so forth. So there is an awareness on the part of the scholarship that the events aren't as easily packaged as they used to be, that they're not strictly interstate, and most of the lethality out there, most of the casualties, that's really coming from things that don't look like old school wars.
So it's really almost like there's this continuum of conflict that ebbs and flows rather than something with a beginning, a middle, and an end.
That's right. And to the extent that you can even find a beginning, middle, and end, it won't even look like it once did, where there's a clear declaration of victory by one side or the other, defeat for the other, adversary, and then look what happened with Iraq, a perfect example here, Afghanistan. It just doesn't look anything like the World War II model, where you had the trials in Japan and Germany of war criminals. Here it's so ambiguous and so muddy. When Mary mentions something like, for example, the controversy that has gone on over the detainees at Gitmo, well, that, the last time I looked, was the winning side, right? I mean, it's the winning side that was being criticized for its actions in relation to the quote-unquote losing side or adversary. That's just unthinkable, if you will, until very recently. So that also, in a sense, challenges beginning, middle, end, good guy, bad guy, victory, defeat. It's just a whole lot more gray than black and white.
Chris McKnight-Nichols, let's bring you back in. How do you fit these, say, the war on terror, within a look at American history with its engagement in war or restraining an engagement with that middle ground? And look at it also from this perspective that you have explored with regards to isolationism and the middle ground there.
I think Mary's book really usefully illuminates the best comparison of the war on terror to a historical precedent, and that is the Cold War, a war that's conceived of as having a discrete enemy and a confrontation between two powers. And yet, ultimately, it isn't taking the shape in the present, in terms of the war on terror, or in the past, in terms of the Cold War. It did not take the shape of a kind of conventional war in the way that, say, Clausewitz or others might have articulated such a conflict. In the longer history and historiography, to compare the international relations to history as well, I think the divide is really that scholars have found this gray area in terms of the actual fighting of conflicts and the ways in which, in the U.S. tradition, conflicts have had ramifications well beyond the scope or the seeming time period of a given war. World War I is a great example in terms of the curtailment of civil liberties and the kind of reaction in the 20s and 30s to the civil liberties that had been curtailed in the course of the conflict, that is the Espionage and Sedition Acts and the ways in which those prevented sort of First Amendment rights from being exercised. However, the divide between scholars and the public at large is the one that I think really is being addressed by these questions we're talking about, and that is Americans tend to think of their own history as divided into this neat periodization of wartime and peacetime. And while scholars may have done significant work to add complexity to that and nuance, we're still struck by the sort of consistency of this paradigm between war and peace, even if, as Mary has shown, essentially, at least in the last half of the 20th century through the present, the U.S. has been more or less in a state of wartime throughout that period. Those are essential issues. I think also, in terms of isolationism and international engagement, you see here one of the ramifications of my reading Mary's superb book was thinking through the ways in which so-called peace times are moments to grapple with perhaps the undoing at home and abroad of American ideals. And here my reference before to William James fits in. Americans after the Spanish-American War of 1898 really did begin to grapple with the fact that perhaps having territories and being a colonial power was anathema to the nation's sort of revolutionary origins. That is, as James and the anti-imperialists continued to argue through the early 1900s, that ruling alien peoples against their will was something that no nation born in revolution should do. And so, too, I would say we see in Mary's book and in the unfolding 100-plus years, the ways in which Americans debated their role in the world after conflicts theoretically had ended. So even though American troops, they don't fully come out of Europe until 1923, and the armistice having been in November 1918, Americans in the 20s and 30s are vigorously debating whether or not the nation should employ its troops abroad. However, scholars would argue, note that the U.S. was deploying Marines throughout Central and South America and the Caribbean throughout that period. So the sort of waning and waxing of wartime and peacetime also dovetail with debates over an isolationist or internationalist perspective on committing diplomatic and military force abroad.
Now, I'd like to go back to this central question that I believe, Mary Drewjack, your book is ultimately addressing, which is when we are in a supposed wartime, a time of war, it erodes much of the public's vigilance and engagement, as well as their civil liberties, so that it's ultimately eroding democratic structures at the same time. What I'd like to do is to have you address this question here, and then I'm going to reverse this to Pat James to look at the effect of democracy on wartime. So first, wartime's effect on democracy.
One thing that's important in our current era is the way that everyday Americans have been encouraged not to be engaged with their nation's military deployment abroad. If you compare that with World War II, sometimes Americans have been encouraged to be engaged, right? World War II, plant the victory garden, buy the war bond, which is a way that the Roosevelt administration tried to get the American people themselves to feel that this was a war that they personally were involved in. Now, fast forward to post 9/11, and of course, we were told not to sacrifice, not to participate, but to go shopping, go on vacation, or the terrorists have won. I think Obama is doing his own version of the same thing. Tie a yellow ribbon, send the troops a thank you note, but let's not be deeply politically engaged with what they're actually doing. And so the more the American people are isolated from the cost of war, which we are, with no draft, with more outsourcing, with more use of high-tech warfare, the American people are isolated from the sacrifice of war and encouraged not to be politically engaged. What that then leaves us with is no meaningful political check on the war powers. I think that we're at a moment in American politics when we have to ask whether there's a means of having a workable restraint on the president's ability to go it alone. And I think the only hope is if the American people are more deeply engaged, then they, through their Congress members, can, whether it's a war declaration or other kinds of congressional action, that's the way the people can have a role, right? In our system, it's generally through Congress. But also we saw in Vietnam the way the people unhappy with the course of the war in Vietnam had their say by getting out in the streets. And so one of the reasons you don't see any meaningful pushback from American war policy is that people aren't engaged, and so we have no democratic accountability.
How does that fit, Pat James, with the democratic peace theory, democracy's effect on war?
Well, the democratic peace theory is about pairs of countries, so it doesn't contradict it in the sense that democracies are very happy to go out and beat up on countries that are regarded as being miserable and unpleasant to deal with. Certainly the United States and other leading democracies like Britain have had no hesitation in going to war. The democratic peace thesis is about, of course, how much the democracies are very fond of each other. It's morphed into a whole gigantic industry of adding in other variables, as in, gee whiz, is it because they're rich, actually, or is it because they tend to be able to have enforceable contracts with each other? Reasonable people, and I'll cut very quickly to the chase about what the research is saying, would say that it's, as opposed to being atomic, it's molecular. It's not so much democracy as a cluster of interrelated traits that the leading countries like the U.S. and, let's say, Britain, for the sake of argument earlier, had. Namely, there's a system leader, the U.S. now, and they tend to be rich, and they tend to be capitalists, and they tend to be investors, and so on and so forth. So really, none of what Mary says would threaten the democratic peace. The much more interesting question, of course, is, all right, if that's intact, what about all this war that seems to be going on? And if I could take a few moments more, I quite agree with her on the disengagement. The symptoms are all over the place that the brilliant analysis offered by Mansur Olson in The Rise and Decline of Nations 30 years ago is right on target, in that take two rather odious traits of the United States right now. One is it's absolutely ridiculous and profligate overspending, and the other is that it's seemingly, you know, almost mindless involvement at times in overseas conflict with no apparent or obvious cost to the public that leads to protest. All of this makes perfectly good sense when you look back at what Olson said 30 years ago, that eventually interest groups of one stripe or another, if left unchecked, will take over and dominate a political system. So I would say that what we have ultimately right now is what Eisenhower warned us against when he left office in 1961, a very powerful military industrial complex that is eating money up like candy, alongside any number of other interest groups that have created huge, gargantuan even government programs that we can't afford, and the public kind of blithely goes along with it because only now, very, very late in the Obama administration, are the cracks in the edifice starting to come to the surface, as in who wants to lend the United States money anymore, who has enough to do so to afloat American debt. I think these phenomena of huge unchecked government activities are very much connected to each other.
Chris McKnight-Nichols, we're going to give you the last word. I have one thought I'd like to interject here, and that is, you know, George Orwell in 1984 wrote about perpetual war, while Immanuel Kant wrote about perpetual peace. I guess we're not in number two.
Perhaps we are in a state of perpetual war. One thing that both comments just now remind me of is Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy in America argued that one of the most terrifying things for all republics is what he called military glory. And he contrasted the American case with that of Europe, and he got a few of these things right and a few wrong. But what's most interesting, trying to modernize that sensibility and thinking about it in both the legal and international relations as well as historical context, is exactly this, your point, that in a state of perpetual war, one other variable seems particularly salient that we haven't talked a lot about yet, and that is technological change. And Mary mentioned drone strikes. But it seems to me that on questions, say, about the War Powers Resolution of 1973 and whether or not Americans are likely to protest in terms of any of our ongoing conflicts or perhaps future conflicts, the fact that these wars are being waged largely by technological means outside of the purview of Americans and with somewhat dubious international legality strikes me as perhaps the most salient new development here, a change from the sorts of questions that Americans asked after, say, the Second World War. Was the second dropping, if not the first, of an atomic weapon morally justified? For example, we don't seem to be having those sorts of deliberations about drone strikes, at least not significantly. And that would be something that would be good for democracy in the way that Mary lays out in her conclusion.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. So let me thank the three of you, Mary Jujak, professor of law, history, and political science at University of Southern California, and author of several books, including the one we're talking about, Wartime, An Idea, Its History, Its Consequences. Patrick James is the director of the Center for International Studies and a professor of international relations at USC. He's authored numerous books, including Religion, Identity, and Global Governance, Crisis in War, A New Quest for International Peace, and Wars in the Midst of Peace. Chris McKnight-Nichols, professor of History at University of Pennsylvania and author of a number of books, including Promise and Peril, America at the Dawn of a Global Age. Thank you all so very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Maria. Take care.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and special thanks to Ankina Aghasyan, who produces the show with me. Also special thanks to Ismail Karim, our assistant producer. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of this show, you can always go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives. You can keep up with us on the scholarscircle.org or armoodian.com. See you next week.